And this is the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to talk to Stephen Gowans, but Phil Connor, tell us when is Mr. Gowans coming?
Well, he's coming to a lot of places on Sunday the 23rd in Mississauga at the Burnham Thorpe Library, on Monday the 24th at the GCDO Hall, 290 Danforth Avenue, co-sponsored by the Canadian Peace Congress, in Hamilton on Tuesday the 25th, in McMaster on Wednesday the 26th, in St. Catharines on the 26th, and back in Toronto on the 27th at a different book list. So you can get all of that from his website, Gowans WordPress, but that's like 6 talks in 5 days.
6 talks. And he's a relatively quiet gentleman. I think we have Stephen Gowans on the line now. Are you there, Stephen?
Here. Hi, Phil.
Hi. We just pointed out you're going to be, Phil said 7 talks?
Six talks in 5 days.
6 talks in 5 days. So we're all looking forward to seeing you. You don't get out much. That's our opinion. You have a great book, Washington's Long War on Syria. Couldn't be more timely. And you've also written a new article at gowans.wordpress.com, Cruise Missile Attacks, a New Step in Washington's Long Class War on Syria. This is interesting. Of course, I guess it's seems to be a pattern with American presidents, and there was this funny idea that Trump wouldn't be like the other guys, partly because he is so strange. But his behavior here is seems to be just almost in lockstep with Bush, Obama, Hillary, and now Trump, right?
Yes. I mean, there's really no significant departure, if any departure at all, from the main thrust of U.S. foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with regard to Syria. And, you know, in my book that I argue that it has been the U.S. objective since the mid-1950s to purge the Syrian state of its secular Arab nationalist influence, and none of that has changed. I mean, that's been true from one administration to another.
Mm-hmm. That is it's a fundamental point that you that you've been making, and it's so important. Let's remind everybody what the U.S. Has become the preeminent power since World War II. They put a bunch of things in place, things like the IMF, the World Bank, NATO, and it's been like somebody says about rust, it doesn't sleep. Go ahead, if you could enlarge on that.
It's interesting that you mention IMF and the World Trade Organization, because part of the title of the latest article I wrote was the Washington's Long Class War on Syria. And the point I wanted to make here was that the United States war is a class war on an international level. A class war in the sense that if you're a Syrian and you were to live according to the rules set down by the United States through the WTO and IMF, you would be, or your economic opportunities, your opportunities for life would be limited by the prescriptions of, the Washington Consensus, which essentially would relegate Syrians to a subordinate role in the International Division of Labor.
Mm-hmm.
They would be limited to roles of always low-wage jobs, perhaps in basic industry, subsistence farming. And so that's a class war in the sense that a class of people, or Syrians en masse, would have a certain economic condition imposed upon them, and it is an exploitative economic condition.
Mm-hmm.
And the secular Arab nationalists have opposed that and have tried to take control of their own economy, tried to take control of their own politics, have tried to assert their sovereignty to say that we can decide who our allies are, all of which is objectionable to the United States,
mm-hmm.
Which wants Syrians and everyone in the Arab and Muslim world to be subordinate to U.S. economic interests.
Mm-hmm. One of the things striking is that people they invoke language like Western civilization, democracy, And free trade, by the way, they often talk about that. The Syrian government represents those things, particularly in the relationship with the great powers. They represent them more than the great powers do. I mean, as I understand it, certainly reading your book, this the Ba'athist Party was grown out of a concept of secularism, equality of people. I have heard out of his own mouth President Assad say, we believe in liberty, equality, and fraternity. And yet the president of France says he has to go. And the president of the United States actually believes they have the right to impose the wishes of the U.S. government on the people of Syria. So Mr. Assad represents the ideals here, and they represent somehow the negation, do they not?
Yes, and I mean, you bring up an interesting point that I want to mention or expand upon, and that is there's an Italian philosopher named Domenico Losurdo who argues that what the United States does is that it arrogates upon itself the right to define what he says are the boundaries between civilization and barbarism, or to define what universal norms are and what departures from universal norms are. And in so doing, what the United States has done is claimed universal sovereignty, which mm-hmm. is that it denies sovereignty to those that it places in the category of barbarism. And the United States, of course, places itself within the category of civilization. And so you think about it that way, you look at some of the language that U.S. Administration officials have been using in connection with the events in Syria or the alleged gassing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Rex Tillerson immediately said after this event came to light, we'll continue to monitor the terrible situation, but it is clear this is how Bashar al-Assad operates, with brutal, unabashed barbarism. So he immediately declared, Assad guilty of these mm-hmm. charges. Then he later talked about the Syrians violating international norms. So these are norms that the United States arrogates onto itself
yes.
the right to define. Mm-hmm. Or they refer to, or North Korea is an interesting example because we also have some looming provocations against North Korea.
There, yes, I'm glad you brought that up because that is there's a warship approaching North Korea as we talk. Go ahead.
And what's really interesting about that is there are enormous provocations being undertaken against North Korea right now, far beyond, I think, anything we've talked about previously. According to NBC News, top-ranking intelligence and military officials have added these possibilities to the way in which they'll deal with North Korea. They've talked about assassinating the leader, infiltrating special forces into North Korea, sabotaging key nuclear infrastructure. Now, that's interesting against claims that are being made in the U.S. media, in the Western media, that North Korea is engaged in provocation at the moment. They're engaged in provocations because they're testing missiles. Now, I thought this is interesting because you take testing missiles and you declare that a provocation. Well, you declare that a provocation because North Korea is placed in this category of barbarism. So if you're barbaric, then testing missiles must mean that it's provocative. You take the U.S. provocative activities, which are not perceived then as provocations, but are perceived instead as self-defense.
Yes.
Because why? The United States is regarded as being part of civilization. And yet, objectively, planning to assassinate a country's leader, to infiltrate special forces, to sabotage their nuclear infrastructure, to engage in cyber warfare, and everyone acknowledged that the United States is engaged in cyber warfare against North Korea, that is unquestionably provocative.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we declare what's essentially self-defensive measures by North Korean government of testing missiles to be provocation.
And the U.S., by the way, doesn't test them. They actually use them.
Yeah.
And that isn't remarked on except to admire or not.
And they're also talking about reintroducing tactical nuclear weapons into South Korea. which also means that they were there previously.
By the way, over and against the wishes of thousands of people who are in the streets in South Korea, has they actually legally said they want those missiles? I thought that was an unresolved matter, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think their opinion doesn't matter, really. Does it?
We're coming to protect you whether you like it or not.
That's right. Now, interestingly, you can ask, what is the North Koreans' reaction to what's been going on in Syria? They have said, quite perceptively, they said, well, there, that simply proves the fact that us developing a nuclear arsenal is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I think they said the Syria attack thoroughly reminds us, in fact, that it's absolutely dangerous to have any illusions about the United States. And only the military power of our own will protect us from U.S. aggression.
Mm-hmm. This is Stephen Gowans. His book is Washington's Long War on Syria. Stephen Gowans is going to be in Toronto and Hamilton. Phil, by the way, you have those dates there in front of you? I want to make sure.
Yes, Mississauga, Sunday the 23rd, Toronto, Monday the 24th, Hamilton, Tuesday the 25th. And McMaster at Hamilton Wednesday the 26th and St. Catharines on Wednesday the 26th and back to Toronto on Thursday the 27th.
And at those two places, a different book list?
Different book list
and
on the 27th.
One on Danforth.
And the one on Danforth is Monday the 24th at the GCDO Hall, 290 Danforth, co-sponsored by the Canadian Peace Congress. That's at 7 p.m. next Monday the 24th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
two Mondays.
And we're speaking with Stephen Gowans. And Stephen, game of personalizing. In the case of North Korea, of course, they have Hollywood films where they did assassinate the leader of North Korea in the film, and that was considered a big comedy. And when North Korea objected to such barbarous cultural aggression, they just laughed them off. In the case of President Assad, I'm very interested in this point, your thoughts about it. The personalizing of this is why people fall into talking about him as a personality. Of course, it's inevitable. He is a political leader, and his family has been involved in the struggle against colonialism from way back. But to say we want him to go is almost like talking like with crayons or kid stuff, because he is a leader of a party, and he's a leader of a government. So you're talking about, he has to go. You don't mean him. You mean you want to redesign the place, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, they do that with everyone. They always personalize, and then you can talk about the barbarous, murderous dictator mm-hmm. as a way of justifying your actions. But they don't care about Assad. They care about secular Arab nationalists. There's an interesting CIA report on Syria that was declassified. It was written in 1986. It's a very interesting report because it talks about who the United States wants governing Syria. And they say, of course, we don't want any Islamists. We don't want that. But what we'd like are some Sunnis who are business people and are interested in making money. That's what we want. Because then we can work with them, and they'll allow us to make some money as well. But we don't certainly want Arab nationalists or Arab socialists, as they call them, because they're not really interested in facilitating U.S. profit-making activities in Syria and the larger Arab world.
By the way, the sure way to get yourself in trouble with U.S. imperialism is to observe the class differences, right? to say, well, you know, we have impoverished people, we have people without land, and we have a narrow economy that needs to be broad based so that we can provide work. If you say those things, they will come and incinerate the place.
Yes, if you're weak enough, and they can do that. It reminds me of Robert Mugabe from Zimbabwe at the last UN General Assembly meeting. Said, you know, you've imposed sanctions on my country because I've done what a president of a country is supposed to do, and that is represent the interests of the people within the country. And that's precisely what they do. I mean, they don't care about the interests of people in Zimbabwe, the United States government, and we'd be naive to think that they did. They care about the interests of the most influential sector in the United States, which is corporate America.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and in addition, I recall that Britain acknowledged that they were going to provide money to the government of Zimbabwe, which they never they reneged on, which hurt them, of course, mightily. The same thing was done with Vietnam when they got a peace, and then they turned out that the money that Kissinger promised wasn't there. By the way, really, and I guess this is my last question, but the probably the most damaging thing that's being done is not just the backing of armed terrorists, but the sanctions and the closing off of the undermining of the economy of Syria, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's where Canada plays a big, dirty role.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And you know, there's all this talk about the cruise missile attacks on Syria, which are bad, but they're high-profile attacks. But the impact they've had is vastly overshadowed by the devastating impact that sanctions have had on Syria, which have been in place since 2003. So 14 years.
Yes, and leaders like Trudeau and Obama do that with as though it's just a shrug. Sanction is a devastating weapon, and the absence of medicine. We've all remembered, I hope, that they did that to Iraq, and they acknowledged that 500,000 children, that was the United Nations, said 500,000 children died because of that.
Which is more deaths than all the weapons of mass destruction used in history. So in effect, what they did was drop two atom bombs, the atom bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima in Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how devastating it was. And it's been pointed out by people like Patrick Coburn, the veteran foreign correspondent, that the kinds of sanctions that have been imposed on Syria are exactly the same kinds of sanctions that were imposed on Iraq. And mm-hmm. that a UN leaked UN report last year has said that, or has acknowledged the devastating impact these sanctions are having.
Yeah, which means that this is going to be one wicked contest with different players are involved. Your essays are very great on this. The book, Washington's Long War on Syria, I hope everybody gets a copy, gets an autograph from Stephen Gowans himself. We look forward to seeing you in Toronto, Stephen.
Oh, thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you, too.
All right. And this is the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. Phil, tell us again where Stephen's going to talk and get the – we want the address.
In Toronto on Monday the 24th at 7 p.m. at the GCDO Hall at 290 Danforth Avenue. And on Thursday the 27th at a different book list cultural center at their brand new spanking location, 777 Bathurst Street.
All right. Very good. I want to thank, of course, we mentioned our earlier reference, the Vimy Trap, in the book by Ian McKay and Jamie Swift. Ian McKay is going to be talking tonight, 7 o'clock, at Steelworker Hall and 25 Cecil Street. This is a keeper, as they say in books. You need it on your shelf as a ready reference. There's stuff in there that I'm not saying I read a lot, but I was surprised at what I found. And so, Ian, thank you very much. Phil Conlon, thank you very much. This is Phil Taylor for The Taylor Report. Oh, by the way, it's The Taylor, Facebook.com/ The Taylor Report, Facebook.com/ The Taylor Report. Oh, and there's going to be a membership drive. I heard a ghost pass through the room. There is, yes, it's coming up. It's in May. May what?
May 8th.
May 8th. Yeah. Well, and I know you're going to be there for us because you love this station. And we'll see you next week.